Matthew chapter 19. We come to verse 27 that says, "Then answered Peter," and he will do that. We looked at the rich young ruler come to Jesus saying, "Master, what good thing must I do to inherit eternal life?" One of the other Gospels tell us falling down and worshiping before him. And certainly gives us a bit of the indication of this ruler. He was going defiantly against all of the instruction of the religious leaders who had instructed everyone to turn away from Christ, that anyone who would have anything to do with him would be excommunicated from the temple in Jerusalem, the synagogue. And here's this young man coming. He's wealthy. He has power. He's young, and yet he's empty. He has all of the things that so many people in this world strive after, and he begs Christ, "What thing can I do to inherit eternal life?" And Jesus challenges him. "Why call me good? We know, we went through it last week." And then he says, Jesus recites the second table of the law to him, he says, "All of these have I kept from my youth up. What lack I yet?" And Jesus said, "Go sell what you have. Come follow me. Give it to the poor. And you'll have everlasting life." And it says he went away sorrowful. And hopefully he turned at some point and was saved. Jesus said how difficult it is for those that are rich in this world to enter into the kingdom. They can hardly be saved. The disciples are amazed because they associated wealth with God's blessing. Thought those that were wealthy were closer to God. And Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom. But with God, all things are possible. Peter now is locked onto this idea with the way he does that. The rich young ruler went away sorrowful. And Jesus said it's difficult for those who are wealthy to enter into the kingdom. He heard Jesus challenge this young man, "Sell what you have, give it to the poor, come follow me." Peter's mind stuck back there on that statement. Then Peter says, "Behold, we have forsaken all to follow you. What shall we have, therefore?" And Jesus said unto them, "Verily I say unto you, that you which have followed me in the regeneration, when the Son of Man shall sit in the throne of his glory, you also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel," speaking to his disciples. Now, of course, Judas is excluded. But they will rule over the 12 tribes of Israel in the millennium. Interesting. We'll meet these men. Jesus said, "Those of you who have followed me in the regeneration," interesting word. It means literally again and born, to be born again. "Those of you who have followed me in the new birth, when the Son of Man comes in his glory, will reign over the 12 tribes of Israel. You'll sit on 12 thrones." Jesus challenging him, "You followed me in this new experience, being born from above or being born again. And then that you followed me and you've given your life and come after me." As Peter said, we've left all. He says, "You will receive." There will be the time that will come. Your reward and ruling over the tribes of Israel with me. And everyone, now he includes us, that hath forsaken houses, or brethren, family, sisters, father, mother, or wife. Now, I want to say this. There's too many people that come up with lame excuses for leaving their wives or their husbands in spiritual terms. Remember, when we started this chapter, the Pharisees came to Jesus and say, is it lawful to put away your wife for every cause? So we have dealt with that subject. And Jesus is very pointed about the fact that only in the cases of adultery, biblically, is there reason for divorce. So here in this situation, certainly he is speaking about those who have seen their families, and not by their own desire, destroyed by their coming to the faith. Paul, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, says to let the unbelieving partner depart. There are times when the partner can't stand the fact that you've come to the faith. I think of a great friend here in the fellowship. He had come to Christ before he had come to Christ, spent a lot of times at the casinos, spent a lot of time gambling, drunk, comes to Jesus, is in the regeneration, he's born again, life has changed, no more gambling, no more drinking, no more chasing women, and his wife hates his guts because she don't think he's fun anymore. She liked it better when he was gambling, drinking, and she was wondering why he was out late at night. So certainly there will be those in that circumstance who come to Christ, and as Jesus said, he hasn't come to bring peace but a sword, because there will be division sometimes if we stand up for Jesus. But he's not giving any of us who have Christian spouses an excuse. That's not the point here. But he's saying those who have forsaken their lives to follow me, lands, any of that for my name's sake, shall receive a hundredfold and shall inherit everlasting life. But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. So he uses this phrase. Certainly it applies to Israel. Those that are first had opportunity at the kingdom will be last, and those that are last, the Gentiles, would be received openly. But he's challenging Peter on his question. You know, I think Peter's motivation in this is, you know, he watches the rich young ruler. He hears Jesus say, get rid of everything you have, give it away, come follow me, and you'll have everlasting life. And he watches the guy kind of wander away with his head down, and Peter's wheels are turning. He's thinking, okay, Lord, we've left everything. What are we going to get? You know, and Jesus knows that motivation of what are we going to get is not the proper motivation. I mean, what should we ask for? We've already been forgiven all of our sins. We've already been washed and cleansed of more than we can imagine. When we get to heaven, I think we'll be shocked at the sins that were washed away that we weren't even aware of. Let alone, okay, now what are we going to get? Like, you owe us some more good stuff, you know? And that's kind of the spirit of the question as Peter's asking. So Jesus kind of says, look, nobody's going to be shortchanged. God's not going to owe anybody anything. But just realize there are those who are first that will be last, and there are those who are last who will be first. No chapter break in the Greek, and he tells this parable now in light of Peter's question. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which went out early. Now he's going to deal with the attitude of, what am I going to get out of the kingdom? He went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. And we're going to be looking at that, the grape harvest. And it was typical for the man to set up a contract early to get his laborers in line to go into the vineyard at the grape harvest. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny, he sounds cheap, but that's a denarii in the Greek, it's a day's wage, good pay, honest day's wage, he sent them then into his field. Early in the morning, we're assuming it's 6 a.m., because that was how the Jews measured the day, from the first hour, 6 a.m. on. And he went out about the third hour, which is about 9 a.m., and he saw others standing idle in the marketplace. Now, that was where you went if you were a laborer, and we hear about it in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and you were looking for work. You would go stand in the marketplace, and then sometimes if you were a carpenter, you'd have your tools or whatever your trade was, or you'd go there, you were just willing to labor to do anything, and people who needed help would go in the marketplace and hire you, and you'd be brought in for the day to work. So, you know, kind of like Job Corps, or the services we have today where you go stand in line to see if anybody needs somebody for the day. So they're standing in the marketplace 9 a.m., 3 hours after the day starts. This now man goes there and sees them standing in the marketplace. He says to them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, I will give you. And they went their way. He didn't bargain with them for a price. He just, whatever's fair, that's what you're going to get. And he went out again about the sixth hour, that's noon, and about the ninth hour, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he did likewise. Now it's telling us something. Sounds a little bit strange for us because nobody hires that way. But in this day, particularly at the end of August, beginning of September, when the vineyards were ripe and it was time for the grape harvest, the rainy season would follow shortly after that, and it would begin then, and there would be showers at times. If the man who was concerned about harvesting the vineyard would see the sky overcast or it looked cloudy, particularly if it got cloudier as the day went on, he would go out and look for laborers because the rain would ruin the grape harvest. harvest. Once it got wet and they tried to store it, it would get moldy, it would ruin the wine, it would ruin the grape harvest. So if it looked like the rain was going to come, he would go out even 3 in the afternoon looking for people that were willing to come and try to get the grapes in before the rain started. So undoubtedly, this is a picture that those that are listening are quite familiar with. Now about the 11th hour, and this is pretty remarkable, this is 5 p.m. now, dinner time, when most people who work are looking at the clock, 4:45, 5:10, 5:05, waiting for the whistle to blow. About the 11th hour, he went out and he found others standing idle, and he said unto them, "Why stand ye here all day idle?" They said, "Because no man has hired us." Now, see, the interesting thing is when we read that, we think, well, they're bums. No, the remarkable thing is they stayed there all day, and it's an evidence of how badly they needed work. Because people that were in this position, it was a day's wage, a denarii they would work for, and that would basically supply for them and for their family. If they found no work, their kids may not eat that night. So remarkably, at 5, they are still waiting. They are still looking for work. And the idea there were those who had not been called, who were there, who were ready. And now the man who's in charge of the vineyard says, "Why are you still standing here? 5 o'clock. No man has hired us." He says to them, "Go ye also into the vineyard. Whatsoever is right, that shall you receive." So when evening was come, and this is somewhere 6 to 7, sun begins to set, the Lord of the vineyard said unto his steward, "Call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning from the last, even unto the first." Now, Deuteronomy had commanded them this in the law: "Thou shalt not oppress a hired servant," that's someone you hired for the day sometimes, "that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in the land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it, for he is poor and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee." So the law had given them a requirement. If you hire someone on a daily basis, normally, as it says here, this is a poor man, and he's working for that day's wage. He needs it. So now the owner of the vineyard comes, says to the steward, "It's the end of the day. Pay them, and pay them from the last that you hired at the 11th hour, 5 o'clock, unto the first." And when they came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a denarii, a day's wage. And when the first came, they thought that they should receive more. And they likewise, every man received a penny. So when the guys that got hired at 6 in the morning saw how gracious the owner of the vineyard was, and they see the guys that were hired at 5 in the afternoon getting a denarii, they're thinking, let's see. They start at 5, quit at 6, they get a denarii. We should be getting 8 denarii. Now, we've been working since 6 in the morning. We should be getting 12 denarii or 10 denarii. They think, oh, this is great. But when it came for them to get paid, they came up and they got 1 denarii put in their hand also. And like some human habit that I've never heard of before, they begin to grumble. And when they had received it, they murmured, verse 11, against the goodman of the house, saying, "These last have wrought but 1 hour. Thou hast made them equal unto us, which have borne the burden and the heat of the day." You know, the point is, as we look at this, it's in context of those who are willing to forsake all and follow me. Peter's question is, we've left everything. What will we have? But his motivation seems wrong in asking, what are we going to get out of this? And Jesus says, I'll tell you the truth. You're not going to be shortchanged, but I also want you to understand another thing. There are those that are last that shall be first, and first that shall be last. In other words, the soul of every man is precious in the sight of God. And every man that forsakes to follow him will be rewarded. And one soul is not more precious than another, because we've been saved for 20 years, maybe even saved 50 years. And someone comes up the front of the church afterwards with a purple mohawk and 17 earrings and gets saved. And some people think, you know, Lord, here I am my whole life. I've done this, and I've, you know, I'm neat. I wear this, and I raise my kids in a Christian school. But, you know, look, who are these kids coming in here like that, bare feet, mohawk, you know, just. And the Lord says, no. One soul is as precious as the other. The idea is there is a cost in forsaking all, whether we do it 50 years ago, whether we do it tonight. And there is a cost to the good man. And to him, no cost is too great, because he loves all the same. So he's challenging Peter in regards to our motivation for serving, because there's going to be somebody who gets saved on their deathbed in a hospital. And I thank God for life support systems for those people. You know, there are people, if it wasn't for life support systems, they'd have gone off into eternity lost, gone to hell forever. But because someone was able to keep them alive on a machine, and the hospital may have thought, well, we're getting everything Blue Cross and Blue Shield will pay out of this one. But God was thinking, I'm getting everything out of this. I'm getting this soul. And some Christian nurses there, some of the nurses, again, one of the guys here that comes to church once in a while was saved in a coma, car wreck, laying in the emergency ward. He said as he laid there, he could hear. He was aware of everything around him. He couldn't move. He was in a coma. And he heard the doctor say to his wife, we don't think he's going to make it. And he said, I had been a nominal Christian. I wasn't saved. And he said, when I heard that, it shocked me. He said, even though I couldn't move, he said, I cried out to Jesus for mercy, and I felt myself born again in a coma. So I felt the Spirit come in my heart. I felt myself enlivened. My fear went away. I was filled with peace. He said, the first thing I thought is, who's going to tell my brothers? They're never going to believe this, you know. And of course, he lived because he told me the story. But the idea for some people, you know, that's great. I don't want to personally lay around on one of those things, but the thief on the cross, the end of his life, says to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. That's all. He doesn't know the sinner's prayer. He doesn't know the four steps. He doesn't know, just Lord, have mercy on me. And Jesus says, I tell you assuredly that today you'll be with me in paradise. Isn't it funny? You know, some people, they begrudge somebody who was a pervert or a murderer or a rapist or a drug pusher on death row. I thank God that they get saved. Because of whatever human sin we can do and how terrible it is, when you measure that against an eternity separated from God in outer darkness, you can't wish that on anyone. On anyone. And there are those. So I think he's telling us that God is gracious. Aren't we glad that he's gracious? We don't want what we deserve from him. What if he gave us what we deserved? We don't want what we deserve. How can we begrudge somebody else when they don't get what they deserve? We don't want hell. We don't want, you know, what if he gave us what we deserved? I'm glad he's gracious. But then that rule applies to everybody else around me, too. That's the tough part about it. Because sometimes I'm thinking, Lord, can you just tighten the screws on that one just a little bit? Lord, make them square them just a little. Well, no, I don't want that applied to me. So I think one thing that he's saying is he is gracious, a gracious steward and a gracious Lord to all that come at the last hour, the first hour. I think the other thing he's telling us is we got to look out for envy. Because we're like that. We can be envious of somebody else's blessing. You know, we can work in the vineyard all day and see a certain amount of fruit, and somebody else comes along at the last minute. They seem fresh. They haven't been out in the heat of the day. They're excited. They seem to accomplish a lot. And you think, why? This guy didn't go to seminary, or this person, you know, they didn't grow up in a church, or what do they think they're doing over there, worshiping, raising their hands? And, you know, we have to be careful. Because we can be envious. When they received it, they murmured, verse 11, against the good men of the house, saying, these last have wrought but 1 hour. Thou hast made them equal with us, which have borne the burden of the heat of the day. But he answered one of them and said, friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst thou not agree with me for a day's wage? Take that is thine and go thy way. I will give unto this last even as unto thee. God is sovereign. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with my own? Is your eye, King James, evil? The Greek is envious. Is your eye envious because I am good? Isn't it interesting? And what he's doing is warning Peter, because Peter says, what are we going to get out of this? And again, you know, we have talked about it over and over again. The important thing is your faithfulness. not the scope of what you've accomplished, because that's God's gift. There's two things that are coming to play here, coming to bear upon the parable. One is that you're willing to forsake all. So one of you may have forsaken all 30 years ago. Somebody may forsake all this evening before the night's over. And the point is, to God, one gets the same gracious treatment as the other. On the other end, when it comes to rewards, we're rewarded according to our faithfulness, not to what is accomplished. And again, you know, Chuck Smith is someone who I admire. I consider my spiritual father and my pastor. And I look at 700 churches across the country and churches all around the world, and I think, wow, you know, so you think, what are his rewards going to be? Well, really, all that has been accomplished is God's work, and God will reward him according to how faithful he was. And I'm sure there's some grandmother here that sits with us every week and is as faithful with her grandchildren, with the ministry God's given her, as some other man is with hundreds of churches, and their reward will be equal, because they'll be rewarded according to faithfulness and not according to the scope of ministry. I think the question is, how faithful were we in serving? So the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. For many are called, few are chosen. And this is in context of their rewards here in this interesting verse. Jesus, going up to Jerusalem, took the 12 disciples aside, now apart, in the way. So somewhere now, as they're headed down the Jordan Valley to go up to Jerusalem, and they're probably on the side of Pyrea, they come down the Jordan Valley instead of going through the area of the Samaritans, cross over by Jericho, and we'll see that. He comes to Jericho, and then they go up. Jericho is about 1,000 foot below sea level, somewhere around there, and Jerusalem 2,500 foot above sea level. So it's uphill all the way from Jericho. Somewhere in that trek down, he takes these 12 guys aside, and he starts to talk to them. He says, "Behold, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man shall be betrayed unto the chief priests and unto the scribes, and they shall condemn him to death, and shall deliver him to the Gentiles to mock and to scourge and to crucify him. And the third day he shall rise again." And by the way, this is not, I don't think, really registering. They short circuit every time they hear this, because they've left all to follow him. And he's been talking about that. And they're thinking, we've left all to follow. What are we going to get? Because they're still expecting him to set up his kingdom. And now he caps off the teaching by saying, look, we're going there. They're going to crucify me. They're going to scourge me. They're going to mock me. They're going to put me to death. And of course, it's no shock. Peter will say on the day of Pentecost, by the predetermined counsel and foreknowledge of God. It was all planned. As we looked in the Old Testament, we realized it was all. And Jesus is completely in control of the situation. He's willingly going to Jerusalem to offer himself up. He knows what's waiting there. I mean, if somebody told me, okay, you're going to Jerusalem, it's south from here, head south, it's about a 4 or 5 day journey. When you get there, they're going to get a hold of you. They are going to condemn you to death. They're going to spit in your face. They're going to beat you beyond human recognition. They're going to rip your beard out of your face. They're going to scourge you. They're going to put you in so much pain it's unbelievable. They're going to put a crown of thorns on your head. They're going to nail you to a cross naked. I'd say, okay. And as soon as they walked away, I would head north. You understand? And all of this is known to him. He is in complete control of the situation. Those who would take advantage of him and mock him and beat him, they are not in charge. They are not taking him against his will. He is going willingly to lay down his life for us. Here this evening, he knows us. He knew us then. He loved us. The thing I like about it is he always ends by saying, and on the third day, he will rise again. He tells us in Hebrews chapter 12, that was for the glory that was set before him, he endured the cross. I think that's important, because you hear Christians say, well, you know, it's heavy, you know, the lot in life that God's given me, or, yeah, that's my cross to bear, or, you know, you hear Christians say, yes, I'm really bearing this cross. This is really, God's demanding this discipleship of me. You know, cut me a break. Every time Jesus talks about the cross, he talks about the resurrection. He never talks about the cross without talking about the resurrection. And if we're his followers, yes, we may have a cross to bear. Yeah, he may have called us to a difficult ministry, but we should also, every time we should also talk about the resurrection. Because what is ahead of us It says the present sufferings are not worthy to be compared for what he's got ahead of us. You know, how are we living? Are we living with less? Are we living with, you know, very difficult circumstances? I mean, Sunday morning, our study, I look at that city. I look at those streets. I look at those walls of jewels. I think, you know, are we really have the guts to say, well, I gave up a good job to follow Jesus, you know? I gave up this little ratty house that was going to rot. I was going to have to paint it and cut the grass and work on the house and redo the plumbing and fix everything that was leaking and work on this for the rest of my life. It was going to fall apart anyway. My body's falling apart, you know, everything. And oh yes, it's very, you know, I'm making a giant sacrifice, trading all that away for just a city that's where the streets are gold and the walls are jewels. And all, you know, isn't, are we so crazy in our logic? Every time he talked about it, he talked about the resurrection. Now, it's obvious that it's not registering because it says, then came to him the mother of Zebedee's children with her sons, worshiping him and desiring a certain thing of him. He says to her, what is it? It gives me the indication. Now, it's interesting. Mark tells us that it's the two boys. It's James and John that come. Matthew, who's an eyewitness, knows that these guys, conniving, got their mom to ask. Because he was an eyewitness. Mark wasn't. He just hears about the dialogue and the question. Now, if you read, and it'll be on the tape, Matthew 27, verse 56, Mark chapter 15, verse 40, and John chapter 19, verse 25, you learn that her name is Salome, and that she's Mary's sister. So James and John are cousins to Jesus. And maybe they're saying, maybe we should keep this all in the family, Joshua. You know, these boys of mine, James and John, good boys. They could have been lawyers. They could have been doctors. Good Jewish boys. You know, we're all in the same family. When you come into the kingdom, can they sit one on the right hand? Jesus just said, I'm going to Jerusalem. They're going to beat me. They're going to kill me. They're going to crucify me. And now she comes and says, by the way, can my two boys, can they sit one on your right hand, one on your left? So we get the feeling it's not really registering as we look at it. And it says she came and worshipped him, asking him for something. And then he has to say to her, okay, what is it? So she must have been saying, okay, Lord, I'm going to ask you for something. But before I tell you what it is, say yes. Your kids ever do that to you? Or mom, I'm going to ask you for something, Dad. And what is it? No, say yes. Then I'll tell you. You know, it almost has that kind of spirit. She comes worshipping him, asking a certain thing of him. He has to ask her what it is. She's saying, I want something. Now, before I tell you what it is, I want you to look at my boys. Good boys, James and John. He has to say to her, what do you want? Verse 21. She says to him, grant that these, my two sons, may sit, the one on your right hand and the other on your left hand. Mom, you might as well go for broke. If you're going to go for it, you might as well go for the gusto. Jesus says, ye know not what ye ask, and now evidently talking to James and John. Are you able to drink of the cup that I shall drink of? As he said in Gethsemane, Father, let this cup pass, if there's any way. To be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? They said unto him, sure. Now they don't know what they're talking about. They don't know. John will tell us in his gospel many things we didn't realize till after Jesus was glorified what he was saying. They just say to him, yeah, we're able. And he said to them, well, you shall drink indeed of my cup, of his cup. They're not drinking in the sense that their death, their martyrdom, their life will not be propitiatory. It's different. Christ drank of the cup of God's wrath that was poured out without indignation, punishment on sinners. He took all of our sin on the cross, all of our sin. And he was baptized into a baptism that is unimaginable. He was placed into, that's what baptism is, immersed in something that we can hardly imagine. Now he's going to say to them, you will drink of my cup, and you will be baptized with my baptism. The idea is, Paul says, those of us who are persecuted for Christ are filling up the sufferings of Christ. Not in the sense of paying for sin, but in the sense that when Saul was persecuting the church, Jesus appears to him on the road to Damascus and says, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? That when you and I as believers are persecuted, our relatives hassle us, that Jesus looks down that from heaven and considers that, you know, they're taking the heat for me. So, yes, he says to James and John, you will drink of my cup. They, you know, James would be the first martyred in the book of Acts, for the first of the apostles killed. John, his brother, would be the oldest, the last one to die. Very interesting. And you'll be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with, placed into. Let's look at it. Jesus said to them, verse 23, you shall drink indeed of the cup, of my cup, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared of my Father. Talking about rewards. Salvation's a gift. There are rewards. There is our places of glory. Now, what is the cup in regards to us? We know it wasn't Jesus. He paid for our sins. But our death doesn't pay for anybody's sins or the living of our lives for Christ. And it's easy for us right away to think, well, that means martyrdom. Well, it doesn't. Because John lived longer than any of them, and John died of old age in Ephesus. James, his brother, was the first to die in the book of Acts of the apostles, and yet Jesus said that both of them were drinking of his cup and being baptized into his baptism. And I think, to me, what Christ is saying is, you know, you will have the opportunity to lay your life in the Father's hands and to live your entire life for me. Whether that means dying tonight, being shot in the head for being a Christian, or whether that means the martyrdom of a long life. Laying down your life for year after year after year after year with no thanks or reward in this world, but in the world to come. Either one of them can be drinking of the cup that he gives us and the baptism that he gives us, being placed into the situation he places us into and partaking of that, drinking of it. It can be with a martyrdom today, or it can be dying of old age 80 years from now. But the point is, it's not the way we would normally associate it. It has to do with us putting our lives freely into his hands, you know, like leave the driving to us, you know, that it's not our own. Our life is not our own. We're bought with a price. So he says, you guys will drink and be baptized with that they did not understand at that time. But to whom it is given to sit on my right hand and my left hand, that is my Father's work. Now look at verse 24. And when the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the 2. Now, they were the 12 before this. Now they're the 10 and the 2. This, you know, and Jesus just told them before about envying, about people's rewards and positions. Now you got two guys who are trying to worm in. The rest of them still don't understand. Hey, they're trying to get the good seats, right hand and left hand in heaven. And now it's 10 against 2. Well, they were the 12 before. Look how quickly these are the apostles. The whole church is going to be led to them after Jesus ascends. And these guys are now divided. They're no longer the 12. They're the 10 and the 2. Because two of them are being rat finks, trying to sneak around and get the best seats while the other 10 aren't paying attention. And the other guys are thinking, I'm going to get my mom to talk to them. When the 10 heard it, they were moved with indignation against the 2 brethren. And Jesus called them unto him and said, look, you know that the princes, the leaders of this world, rulers of the Gentiles, they exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. That's just the Greek word servant. Whoever would be great, let him be servant. And whosoever will be chief, the head, let him be, different word, slave, demoted even further. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. So they come now, and again, here they are immediately. Peter had said, what are we going to get? He deals with that. Now here are the guys coming back saying, you know, I can't believe these two are trying to worm their way in. You know, we've been with you too. We followed you. We left all, you know, you can imagine these guys erupt into this. You know, and Jesus is going, hey, hey, you know, this is the end of his public ministry. He's trying to communicate with me. He calls them together. It says he comes, okay, guys, come here, huddle. And he calls them over and he says, look, We know that this is the way the Gentiles do things. The greatest one is the guy who gets the power. And isn't that the way the world is? You know, we hear about conspiracy. We hear about all this. It's not no longer just getting money. Because when you get money, you're still not satisfied. Then it's getting power. I heard last week the Fortune 500 in America, the wealthiest 500 families in America, there are now more billionaires amongst those 500 families than ever before. There are 180 billionaires in America amongst the 500 wealth. All the rest of them are just millionaires. And, you know, we hear all this stuff, you know, as people, they get all of that and they realize they're still empty. Then it's power. And he says that this is the way this world works. When you're great, you have power to lord over others. And you have dominion over them. But he says, not so in the kingdom. Because if you want to be great in the kingdom, you should become the servant of all. And if you want to be the chief in the kingdom, not just great, then you should become slave. Because that's the way I've lived my life. Jesus says, even the Son of Man came not to be ministered to, but to minister, to lay down his life a ransom for many. Now, I think it's important as we get there to look at that, because there are those in the church who claim that they should have authority over your life, that you need to, you know, the teaching of authority and submission that's in parts of the church, and the teaching that there are apostles and you need to listen to what they say, and the shepherding movements in the church today. And Jesus says here that that is not the way the kingdom operates. Mark chapter 10, he goes into it in greater detail there. He said that's the way the world operates. 2 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 24, Paul says to a Corinthian church that was all bungled up, he said, not that we have dominion, that's our word here, that they have dominion, the worldly leaders have dominion over one another. Paul says, we don't have dominion over your faith, but we are helpers of your joy. He says to them in Philemon there, he said, I, such a one, an aged apostle, Paul, though I could command you, yet for love's sake, I adjure you, I beg. He says he's not giving any commandment to anyone. Says in Hebrews 13, to obey those of the rule over you, considering the end of their conversation. He's talking about those who are dead and pass off the scene, and to consider, to yield to them, the apostles, those who had been raised up to be leaders in the church by their example. In fact, if you have a Vines Expository Dictionary and you look up those verses, it says right there, this does not apply to authority and submission. Vine put it right in his dictionary. Peter, 1 Peter chapter 5 says that we should not be lording it over the flock of God, instructed. There, Peter's a fellow elder. And of course, in the book of Revelation, twice in chapter 2, the Lord hates the deeds of the Nicolaitans, the Nicao and laity, to domineer over the laity. He hates it. Someone saying that they're between you and Jesus, whether it's a priest or a minister or whoever it is. Jesus knows your phone number and he knows your address and you're his kid and he wants to talk to you. He doesn't want somebody between him and you. Some reverend. People call on the phone and say, it's Reverend Foster. I know, this is a stranger. From this is not part of our church. Reverend Foster. You understand what I'm saying? It says when Jesus died on the cross, the veil in the temple was torn open, where only the priest could go. It was ripped open so that all men can go to God. And Paul talks about the enemies of the cross. There are those who are veil menders. They try to sew that thing back up again, so you need them. And they can go to God for you and find out what God really wants and come back to you and say, no, don't buy a blue Chevy. You know, God wants you to buy a minivan. Or, no, don't do that. Give your money to this missionary. He says, no, let me tell you something. God wants to talk to you. He died. He gave his son so he could talk to you. You are his kid. I don't want anybody between me and my kids at home. They're mine. I want to be with them. I want to talk to them. I want to roll on the floor. I want to drive them crazy. They're mine. Everybody should have one to drive crazy. They're great. And Jesus doesn't want anybody between you and him. That's why he died, so that every man and every woman could come in an open fellowship with God. So he says, no, this is not the way we're going to run the kingdom. If you want to be great, become the servant of all. The way up is the way down. If you want to be the greatest, then be slave. It's exciting, isn't it? You can be a slave. That's what I'm trying to tell you. You can start tonight. Be a slave. You don't see that in the Christian bookstores, you know, bestseller. Be a slave, you know. Oh, boy, what I always wanted to be. This is great. What we remember, our reward is great in heaven. You don't just remember the cross, you remember the resurrection. I was on the class trip last week with the fourth graders, and we went to Pensbury Manor. I like to go on the class trips with the kids. And four of them hit me up for a loan in the gift shop. One of them hit me, and then another one saw it, he hit me, and they were all telling me, come on, Pastor Joe, I'll pay you back next week. I get $2 every other week for allowance. I'll pay you back in 2 weeks. You'll give me $5. I'll pay you back in 2.5 weeks, you know. All right, you know. But there at Pensbury Manor, they're talking about William Penn and his most famous writing. And I'm not much of a reader of William Penn. It was called No Cross, No Crown. It was about his relationship with Christ. No cross, no crown. But his point was, there is a great reward at the end of all of this. And here, yes, be a slave, be a servant. It's not exciting to worldly men because they're working their way up. We're trying to work our way down. But in the long run, we end up ahead. And as they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, when they heard that Jesus passed by, cried out, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And the multitude rebuked them because they should hold their peace. But they cried the more, saying, have mercy on us, O Lord, thou Son of David. And Jesus stood still and called them and said, what wilt ye that I shall do unto you? And they said unto him, Lord, that our eyes may be opened. So Jesus had compassion on them and touched their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight, and they followed him. Now, it's interesting that when you read Mark's account, he says there was a blind man named Bartimaeus, the son of Timotheus. He tells us his name. Mark is writing the record that he heard from Peter. Matthew was an eyewitness. So Matthew tells us there were two. Evidently, one of them is the spokesman. Luke tells us that they were coming into Jericho. Matthew says they were departing from Jericho. So, of course, the Bible critics said, aha, there's another flaw in the Bible there. Well, what they don't tell you is there was an ancient Jericho. It was destroyed in the days of Joshua, and a commandment was given to the Jews never to rebuild it. But because they always listened to everything God said, they rebuilt it. So there was an ancient city of Jericho. Then there was a Herodian Jericho. And the Jews didn't like the Romans. There was a separation between the two population bases. And it was beautiful there. Herod had rebuilt part of Jericho. And there were bathhouses and gymnasiums and saunas and in-ground pools and quite a place. Well, obviously, the Bible's always right. Jesus is leaving ancient Jericho, and Luke, who's writing the Gentiles, says he was approaching Roman Jericho. And of the two blind men that started crying out, one of them was the spokesman. That's the record that Mark gives us. But it isn't difficult at all to erase the controversy. As they departed from Jericho, a great multitude followed him. And they're heading up from Jericho to Jerusalem. Now listen, Jesus headed to his crucifixion. This is one of the mandatory feasts. The normal population of Jerusalem was 500,000, they average. It would swell to between 2 and 3 million at Passover because it was one of the three mandatory feasts. So as they're going from Jericho towards Jerusalem, it says there was a multitude. There were tons and tons of people, thousands, going from Jerusalem to Jericho. And they're following Jesus because there's expectation. The Passover feast was the feast when the Jews were set free from Egyptian bondage. You know the story. So the Romans would always bring extra soldiers to Jerusalem during Passover because there was an air of independence. They were looking for a deliverer. They wanted to get out from under the Roman bondage. So there's a multitude now headed up to Jerusalem. And behold, two blind men sitting by the wayside, When they heard that Jesus passed by, they cried out, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou son of David. So here's these two blind guys. Now, first of all, their function of hearing is heightened because they're blind. Their sensory of hearing is much heightened. It's how they've learned to relate to a world of darkness and to associate with it. Jesus was big news amongst the afflicted. And we see that all through the gospel, because they are the ones who, when they heard that there's one coming who would open the eyes of the blind, to preach the good news to the poor, that the lame would leap like a hart, and the deaf would have their ears unstopped, these afflicted people listened to those verses and thought, oh, how, and now they hear this one, Jesus of Nazareth, is in the precincts of and the vicinity of Judea and of Galilee, and now they hear they had been piecing together, and some of their buddies had come back and said, you know, oh, you got to see this Jesus guy, and they're saying, who are you? And they're saying, well, I'm Sammy. And they're saying, Sammy, what do you mean you got to see? We're blind for years. No, my eyes are open. You got to see him. If you got to him, he'll open your eyes. And, you know, so it was big news. So now they're hearing he's passing by. These two blind guys, they said, what, did you hear that? You know, you can see him hitting each other with the elbow. You're there, aren't you? You know, Jesus is passing by. So they start to scream. They're not going to let this chance go by. Have mercy on us. Their normal cry was alms for the poor. They are not crying for alms. Have mercy on us, thou son of David. They're owning him as the Messiah, and this is a rebuke to the blindness of Jerusalem and the religious leaders as Jesus is headed to Jerusalem, because the religious leader hated him and hadn't received him as Messiah at all. And a last wonderful testimony in some ways against them are these two blind guys who, without eyeballs, see that he's the Messiah of Israel. And they're crying out, Thou son of David, have mercy. They're not asking for alms, they're asking for mercy. They're asking for more. The crowd says to them, the multitude, who are usually not representative of Jesus, by the way, if you're here this evening and you don't know Christ, and you say, well, you know, I never liked church. I didn't either. I never liked to be around Christians. I didn't either. Because usually the multitude is not representative of Jesus. And you can't judge Jesus simply on the basis of Christians. No doubt we as Christians want to live our lives in such a way that you can see a difference between somebody who claims to be a Christian and somebody who's lost. We do want to do that. But when you look real close, you'll find out that we're human. It's shocking. But Jesus is different than the multitude. The multitude rebuked them because they should be quiet, hold their peace. They cried out the more. You know, so you can tell the people, be quiet. Jesus, be quiet. You know, then they say, you must be crazy. Be quiet, you know. Then they scream louder. They cried the more, saying, Have mercy on us, O Lord, thou son of David. Now, Jesus loved to hear this. He wished that he heard this everywhere he went in Israel. Notice it says, Jesus stood still. Now the guys are there, they're blind. They don't know. They hear the procession, no doubt they hear the shuffle of feet. That's their ears are their eyes. They hear something going. People are telling them to shut up, and they're saying, You shut up. They're crying louder. They're screaming out loud. And I wonder, do they hear the whole procession stop? They hear it differently than I would hear it. I would have watched it. And Jesus stands still. Right at that moment, there's some transaction between their heart and his heart, unknown to the crowd. And I hope if you don't know Jesus Christ this evening, that right in the middle of this crowd, there is some transaction taking place between your heart and his heart, even though everybody around you may not know about it. Because that's what's happening. Here's the cry of their heart. We sang it this evening. It is the cry of my heart to follow you. You know, they are crying from the heart. Have mercy on us, thou son of David. Jesus hears that voice through the crowd. All the crowd doesn't silence that. And he stops. And the whole thing comes to a standstill. And he called them. Now what it says in Mark is somebody went and got them and led them to Jesus. Somebody took them and led them. And if you have a friend, by the way, who's been telling you about Jesus, trying to lead you to Jesus, please don't be offended at that. You've been led your whole life anyway. Do you think that somebody all of a sudden just decided, I will have a purple mohawk? Never heard of it before, never seen any, or never seen Last of the Mohicans. This just idea just popped in their minds. You think, again, in my day, I just decided to wear bell bottoms. I look at my jeans and said, you know, all jeans should have a flare at the bottom of them, you know. No, that was what was on the menu. The music that was handed to me, and the LSD that was handed to me, and the clothes, and the styles, all that. I was led anyway. Why not be led to Jesus? I was being led to hell. We're led anyway. We maybe get to pick from the menu, but we don't write the menu. Why? Don't be offended if someone's trying to lead you to Jesus. Jesus stood, he sends somebody for them. And you imagine these guys now, somebody says, come on, come on, come on, the master's calling for you. And they just get up and go. You can imagine that now they're walking in darkness and they're brought now to Jesus, and then somebody lets go of their hands and they're standing there. You can imagine their hearts going, ba-boom, 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 ba-boom. And they hear a voice. What do you want me to do? Imagine that, hearing that out of the darkness. What is it that you want me to do? Gagoom, gagoom, gagoom. They said unto him, Lord, what we want is to see. We want our eyes opened. Jesus had compassion on them, and now they feel the touch of his hand. Touch their eyes, and immediately their eyes received sight. So, and they followed. Imagine this. So here the guy's been blind their whole life. They feel the hands on their eyes. The crowd is still now. It's quiet. And as light starts to come, somebody turns on the light. Says immediately they begin to receive their sight. So they go from black to gray to white to forms to shadows to silhouettes. Those, you know, and the first thing that comes focused in is the face of God smiling. The very first sight that they see when their eyes are open is Jesus. And by the way, that's the very first sight I saw when my eyes were open. Jesus. I had heard about him. I had grown up in a religious system, in a denomination. I never saw him. I was blind. But the day came when he heard me crying out. And it seemed like the procession of life was just going by, and he stopped. And a friend comes Sunday morning here, took me by the hand and led me. I just remember the second I got saved, the first thing I saw was Jesus. He'd been there, I'd heard about him, I knew the facts, crucifixion, resurrection, I will make you fishers of men, sung the songs in Sunday school when I was little. I never saw him. Never saw him. Life-changing experience. Look what it says. It says, touch their eyes, immediately their eyes receive sight. And they followed him. Well, where else was there to go at that point? You know, I mean, here are two blind guys. Probably their whole life they had been heard people talking about flowers. Oh, it's spring now. The Rose of Sharon is blossoming. They must have thought, I wonder what a Rose of Sharon. Did you ever feel one of those? Yeah, here, try. Here's one here. You know, just, you know, or, you know, oh, the palms, the date palms in Jericho. You know, this place is warm. I'm glad we're here, but it must really be beautiful. Or the Dead Sea or the Sea of Galilee. You know, but all of a sudden their sight comes and the first thing they see is the face of Jesus. You just don't want to go see the Dead Sea after that. I mean, where else is there to go? You don't want to go see flowers and date palms. I mean, there was no else for them to go. Where else would they go? The first thing they see is Jesus. You see him smiling at them. They've owned him as Messiah. When their eyes are open, they know he's who they said, see, I told you that's who he was. You know, they've received their sight. There's nowhere else for them to go. They go following Jesus. And it's remarkable, next week as we come in the triumphal entry, you think of this. Here Christ is coming to Jerusalem. He's got blind Bartimaeus and his buddy, who aren't blind anymore, with him. He's got Lazarus, who was dead, who ain't dead no more, with him. He's got Simon, who used to be the leper, who ain't the leper no more, with him. This is an exciting crew coming to Jerusalem, and the crowds and the children be screaming, Hosannas.